everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. Here we are. It's already April 1st, 2014. And I don't have any foolish surprises for you today. I hope you're having a good April Fool's Day, but I think we're going to have a fun but serious show. No tricks, I promise. Okay. This past week I was at the Veggie Pride Parade in Manhattan, which is a really lovely event. It was a little challenging this weekend because we've been having all of this wonderful cold weather, which looks like it's finally inviting a little spring. Hello.
Hello.
Who am I speaking with?
This is Liz Brandon.
Oh, hi. I didn't bring you on the program yet, but okay, let's jump right in it. I'm going to bring on my two guests and talk about my favorite subject for the next half hour, which is kale. And we have here Dr. Elizabeth Brandon from Mississippi College, and she's an assistant professor there in the biology department. And Bilal Kizilbash. How do you say your name, Bilal?
Bilal Kizilbash. You actually said it quite right.
Kizilbash, yes. Well, I'm not going to try and say it anymore. It's a great bunch of letters, and I wish I could use it in Scrabble. And Bilal is a Master of Science candidate in the Biomedical Sciences at Mississippi College. And Bilal and I have a passion for kale, I think. Don't we, Bilal?
Yes, we do.
So thanks for joining me here on It's All About Food. Let's just jump right into the work that you're doing at Mississippi College because it's fascinating. So, Dr. Brandon, would you like to give us a little introduction about your work with kale?
Well, actually, I didn't start working with kale until Bilal joined the lab last year. Because he had not done research before, I let him work with some other graduate students on their research projects. And once he learned some techniques, he came up with an idea of testing the effects of kale juice on melanoma cells. And I said, well, why not? And so I have just recently come to the field, so I'm very new to it. And I have been kind of surprised by the results, and I think it's exciting.
I think it is too. Now, Bilal, I can't even remember when I met you, maybe 2-3 years ago?
Yeah, it was it was close to 2 years ago at this point.
Right. And did you know very much about kale when we first met?
Actually, I knew nothing about kale. It's a funny story how this all began, actually. and that's how most great things start, right?
Yeah.
In regards to the kale, I knew nothing about it. I never even ate kale prior to us meeting. And it was my mother who started doing this whole juicing thing, and she was doing these wonderful fruit juices mixed with some greens like bok choy and whatnot. And she told me, she had me try some of her juices with her, and I was like, wow, this is delicious. It's with strawberry, mangoes, all wonderful things that I've had before, very sweet-tasting juices. And my mom was reading your blog, and she was like, oh, Bilal, you want to try a hardcore juice? And I started laughing because I'm like a guy. So I'm like, yeah, of course, hardcore, let's do it. So she gave me this green juice, and I was like, this tastes awful, and I never want to do it again in my life. This is about 4 days into juicing. However, I noticed something unusual about on the 6th and 7th day. When I went in the shower, I noticed my skin tags were decreasing. It's not only in size and number as well. And skin tags are fundamentally little tumors. They're gene transcription errors. And as my friends and I were growing older, we basically accepted it as a fact of life that we're just going to get more and more skin tags. So we're talking about I was 25 at the time, and a whole lot of my friends ranging from 22 up to 30, all of us as we were getting older were just getting more and more skin tags. So I'm like, okay, why are my skin tags going down? So I started backtracking and thinking about anything new I did in my life at that time. I ate my burger. I didn't really do anything special. And when I started looking back, I was like, oh, it's the juices. So I started asking my mom what she put in the juices, strawberries, mangoes, all sorts of things I've had before, cucumbers, apples, ginger. But what I've never had before was the thing she told me about kale. So I was like, huh, kale is something I've never had before, and I've never had this results before as well. So I started looking into kale, and I couldn't really find a whole lot of scientific research on it in regards to its anti-cancer properties, other than anti-proliferative effects. So at that point, I started looking into forums, and I went to thousands of forums, and I have to tell you, people are really, really vocal when it comes to what they're going through, and you start seeing how the general trend of a lot of them getting better with when they start going to a more natural lifestyle in terms of improving their diet, getting more water, more exercise. But one commonality that I noticed between all the people that actually started getting better and recovering was the common element of kale, which I experienced myself. And I'm like, this warrants further study. But it kind of just fell in the back burner because I wasn't a researcher and didn't really think much of it until, like I said, Dr. Brandon said, when I actually got to a lab and I started doing some work, and I was like, this molecular compound kind of resembles something else. And I was like, maybe this might work. And then we ran with it.
Well, fortunately or unfortunately, I don't know what it is, but when people discover something, but if they don't prove it in a clinical fashion and make it science-based, they don't get a lot of attention. And there's some really valuable information out there. And fortunately, a lot of us can just eat kale. We don't need a prescription for it, and we can discover its benefits. But I think it's the work that you're doing is really important, because I think a lot of people will benefit from it. So let's talk now about what you're doing with kale and the results that you've discovered.
Okay, so to put it very simple, it's a very simple experiment, actually. We took juice curly kale, and we put it directly on the melanoma cells, and it's actually induced apoptosis. And I remember when I first saw it, I was like, this can't be right. So we kept repeating the experiments, and over, I kept seeing cell death. And to help you appreciate this fact, melanoma cells in general are pretty hardy cells. They're pretty tough to kill. So I've been working with kale now for over a year, and I've kind of gotten used to seeing the melanoma cells die because of this. it's kind of funny if you think about it, because it really is that simple, and it's like, it makes you wonder why no one decided to try this before. And there's so many components within kale. There's temporal that has been actually shown to actually induce apoptosis in glioblastoma cells, a type of brain cancer. Then you have molecular iodine that's also present within kale that's been shown to induce apoptosis in human breast cancer cells. And also it doesn't affect normal mononuclear cells. And then you have a ton of other things within kale as well. Some flavonoids that they haven't even named yet. And all these things are working in concert. So basically, let's just talk about three individual components that we could possibly make a new wonder drug. We could take sulforaphane, lecithin, as well as temporal, and probably make the next wonder drug. But then I was wondering, that how about if we go back to nature, where instead of making our own recipe, nature has its own recipe for kale. So let's test that in its natural format, because it's immediately available and it's directly accessible to everyone. And that's how the idea came to be, and that's the experimentation we did and we're continuing to do.
Sounds great. Now, Dr. Brandon, how is it you have the flexibility to do experiments like this? I'm not that familiar, but a lot of times there are grants and there are specific goals that you're looking to achieve.
Sure. Well, I do have a grant, and there are specific objectives that I'm trying to achieve, but because of the broad aims of the program from the National Institutes of Health that funds my grant, I have some room to explore. And the second reason is that Mississippi College is not a research institution. We are primarily an undergraduate college. We do have some master's level programs, but we use research as a teaching tool. It's we teach full time and we do research when we can with students as we can. And our primary goal with introducing students to research is to open their eyes to the possibility of becoming a professional scientist. And I think that exploration is absolutely essential for that, because when people get the chance to discover something new, there's nothing like it. There is no other feeling like that in the world. And you want more of that, and you want to share what you've learned with other people. So I do have money that I can use for projects like this. Bilal is doing the control experiments now with normal non-cancerous epithelial cells, and so hopefully we will have some results with those controls in a couple of weeks. But this research that he's doing is not very expensive. He has the juicer already. He made the juice samples and stored them in frozen vials in the freezer. The melanoma cells are currently being used for other projects in the research lab, and so to me, this is a no-brainer. Why not explore foods like this in their natural form? Because it is the right balance of chemicals that makes these foods so healthy and even palliative or useful for healing in some cases.
Now, with your study on melanoma tumor growth, have you seen results like this, like you've seen with the kale juice?
I have. We have played with the metabolism of melanoma cells, and all cells have flexibility with the fuels that they use. They can oxidize carbohydrates. They can oxidize fatty acids. They can even obviously build the biological molecules that they need. But when cells are stressed out, they can easily switch from one fuel source to another, and that's an adaptive response that all cells have. And cancer cells are no different in this respect. And we found that if we forced cancer cells or our melanoma cells to oxidize pyruvate, then that induced apoptosis in the cells. And the other things that we've been looking at are inflammatory cytokines that may be produced by immune cells, and trying to understand that paracellular communication that occurs between melanoma cells and immune cells or cells like adipocytes. So this kind of BELOS research kind of dovetails with what we are looking at anyway. So it's a nice fit for our lab.
Well, the thing that I noticed when I read the summary is the fact that it's the whole kale or the juice kale that is having the impact that it does. And so often in research, which is funded by pharmaceutical companies, and Bilal mentioned this before, companies want to isolate something so they can put it in a pill and profit from it. And
yeah.
I mean, it looks like a lot of us talk about this all the time, but the whole food is actually the most powerful, beneficial thing we can use.
Right, and it's the least toxic. And so in many cases.
Yeah.
I love that you brought that up, actually, because let's just throw some numbers on that to give you an idea of what's going on. So we started one experiment with 200,000 cells, and by around day four, the regular melanoma cells were at around 4 million cells. So from 200,000 to 4 million, we have the Sonic Hitted, which is a slightly distilled format of the juiced curly kale. Fundamentally, what we did is we Sonic Hitted it with the Sonicator, which is just vibrating it very quickly at over 20,000 hertz to liberate whatever's in the cell membrane into suspension, and then we microfiltered in a 0.22 micron filter. So there were some isolates in that, and that took the 200,000 melanoma cells starting off to, and it went by day four to 700,000. So you can just compare right there an immediate difference between 4 million and 700,000. That was a drastic drop. Now, speaking about the actual natural vegetable repeatedly, I'm talking about, I've been doing this for, well over a year now, repeatedly, the natural vegetable in its whole format, we're talking about just directly from the juicer, consistently dropped the melanoma count to zero. It does it very rapidly, in fact.
Wow.
Yes. So even though the Sonic, which was the still format that we're talking about, sulforaphane, chemprol, quercetin, a whole bunch of other things was in there, but the whole natural vegetable has agonist and antagonistic factors combined in a natural balance. That's wonderful. That continuously kills the melanoma cells down to zero. And this is, like I said, by the day four reading, it was zero. Sonic hitted 700,000, and regular melanoma cells 4 million.
Dr. Brandon, have you started drinking kale juice yet?
Well, I eat kale leaves, so I don't have a juicer, but I like to put kale in my salad, and I think the flavor is good. Bilal gave us some juice samples when he first started juicing, and some of the students in the lab didn't like the flavor very much, and so he blended some pineapple in with it, and it was really good. But I even like the raw kale juice. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it, again, it's one of those things that if you include it in your diet along with a balanced diet with other fruits and vegetables, you know, I think it can be very, very beneficial. And there may be conditions where people want to increase their consumption of kale periodically in order to treat certain conditions that they have. I think obviously the next thing to do is to do an in vivo study with animals using a tumor model to see if the application of kale juice directly to melanoma tumor cells causes regression in the tumor.
Right. So are you planning on doing a study like that?
Well, we don't have the animal facilities at Mississippi College, but we are about 15 minutes away from the medical school where there is a huge research institution. And so I have friends there that would probably be happy to get involved in a project like this. So it
could
extend.
How about human animals?
Well, and that's fine too. You know,
because it's not a toxic treatment, it
right.
can provide people with an instant benefit. I don't like to hear about animal experimentation. I know it goes on
yeah.
all the time, and there's some that's less offensive than others, and I understand
sure.
that's how we operate on currently, but I like testing on people.
Yeah, well, and
that
was the motivation behind Bilal's publication of his research poster and his research results on an open science website so that anybody has access to his research results, and if they're interested in trying kale juice themselves, they can. I think that's a very important thing to do. Oftentimes, it takes so long to investigate something scientifically that by the time the research results are actually published, you know, you've missed a lot of opportunities for people to benefit from what you've learned.
Right. So
yeah, that's why I published my work on the Center for Open Science, as Dr. Brandon said. And actually, speaking about human experimentation, we do actually have it. The people experimenting on themselves, if you read the forum posts, a lot of the people with stage 4 cancer, they're kind of desperate. So you start seeing that they're willing to try almost anything and everything, including some people are ingesting cyanide pills. And it's not a very good type of experimentation, but the people are fundamentally experimenting on themselves at this point. Like I mentioned before, when I was reading through the various blog posting and the forum posting, the common element of kale and people starting to get better. But, however, a lot of the doctors, here's one of the famous quotes that I had happen a lot in one of the forums, that the doctors would tell them that the dark side to the leafy green vegetable, which technically the doctor would be right in regards to blood origin when it comes to, let's say, broccoli or, you could mention a whole, goitrogens are common in almost all types of natural products. It's actually highest in soy. So I'm saying, you know, if a doctor's going to tell a patient to be careful of goitrogens, they have to tell them in particular to be careful of soy, so that has the highest level of goitrogens. And guess what? Soy is in almost every processed food out there. So instead of recommending their patients be careful, and their patients are telling the doctor that they're getting better. And the other thing with that is another common thing in the forum posting is the doctors say that it was a psychosomatic effect, which our research kind of shows that it's not actually, not kind of, it doesn't show that it's not a psychosomatic effect, but an actual molecular basis to this.
Well, it's very frustrating to see the arrogance that often comes out from a lot of very reputable, intelligent people, where they don't want to see something that may be so simple and so pure and not connected to a big profit motive.
I don't know. I guess maybe arrogance. I'm not entirely sure if it's all arrogance. Maybe it's more ignorance, because when I spoke to a few doctors about the goitrogen aspect, some of them did tell me, oh, you have to be careful with kale because it can induce goitrogen. And I said, actually, there is some competitive research saying that the molecular iodine actually works competitively against that. But I said, you're right, technically, with people starting gorging on broccoli. That's completely right. You could actually start impairing thyroid function then. But at the in regards to the tail, there's, like I said, there's iodine in it, so it actually ends up acting in an antagonistic fashion to the goitrogens. So if people are really genuinely concerned about goitrogens, I would highly recommend they be careful of processed food more than leafy green vegetables.
Yeah, my understanding is it really isn't a big problem, and if people are aware that the only issue is iodine and making sure that you get enough and you don't have to really consume a lot to get enough, but this goitrogen issue is not significant. And I remember hearing one study of a woman who had some serious problems, and she was eating like 25 pounds of bok choy a day and nothing else.
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, yeah, it was really crazy. But, you know, that's where you get some of the fears coming out when you have something really extreme.
Yeah.
But in most cases, there's nothing bad that kale could do, and especially when we're comparing it, one, to strengthen our own immune system to prevent disease, and then for those that are in a crisis, to be able to use something like kale juice, and if it's possible to use it instead of some toxic chemotherapy, which we all know with chemotherapy, it's a race between killing the cancer and killing you.
Yeah. Yeah.
We need a better alternative.
Well, we also need a cost-effective alternative. While also speaking about toxicity, almost anything can be toxic, including water. If you take water and you just go nuts with it,
right.
You can actually have a dramatic osmotic effect in the body. So in regards to toxicity, let's say you just went and you rapidly drank, 17 gallons of water. You will probably kill yourself.
Mm-hmm.
That's the reason why you wouldn't think of water being toxic. It's like putting a warning label on a water bottle. It may potentially kill you. It could also drown you. But it's depending upon how you use it, as well as the quantity, rate of ingestion. There's so many nuances in there, but the brain automatically regulates itself unless you have a psychosis. So fundamentally, you shouldn't really have an issue unless, like I said, you have a psychosis. So eating kale leaves, to overdose on it, you would have to eat a lot of it, and naturally people get sick of it. I mean, even if you love pizza, you eventually get sick of it. You eat too much pizza, you eat too many hamburgers, let's say you eat 14 burgers, you're like, wow, I do not want any more burgers, I don't want any more pizza, I don't want any more kale. The brain automatically regulates that for you. Now, taking it potentially in a pill form, it would circumvent that. That's when you can potentially get into a real danger issue. Like 25 pounds of bok choy, that's a lot of anything. And let's say even eating 7 pounds of, let's say, a burger, as much as someone might love the burger, you'll eventually get fed up with it. You just can't take any more. Now, we're not getting into the chemical engineering aspect. Let's talk about Doritos. Because a chemical engineer cannot give you that satiety. So you can actually circumvent that. But in terms of natural foods, they don't have any type of specific engineering to avoid that. So naturally, your brain's going to be like, okay, buddy, chill with the kale.
Yeah, well, I think kale is an amazing food, and you're discovering how really wonderful it is, and I look forward to learning a lot more about it. Now, I had asked you a few questions, and I'm going to ask them again because I think what I learned was interesting. So you're using a pretty basic Breville centrifugal juicer for your experiments, right?
Yes. I'm using the Breville Icon.
Okay. And there are lots of different models out there, and many times people will ask me and ask others, you know, what's the best juicer? And there are masticating juicers that actually chew the food, twin gear or single gear. There's the centrifugal kind, and people talk about the cell of the juice actually being destroyed with some kinds versus others. And a lot of people promote the masticating juicer as the best, but it's the gentlest. But you're using a centrifugal juicer, and you've gotten outstanding results with it.
Yes. Well, with the masticating juicer, they're wonderful for several things. It's like a tool. Like you get certain types of hammers that are useful for certain scenarios. The centrifugal juicer works best in particular for kale because it also stimulates the actual, chewing your food really, really finely, and also it activates the sulforaphane within it, which is activated by chewing if you were to chew your food. Now, that's a whole separate issue because most people don't chew their food properly, but this would be this would be stimulating chewing your food really, really, really super well. And also the other thing is time factor, because masticators are much slower, and a lot of people are really, really busy. So the centrifugal juicer just ends up being an excellent balance. You do get some oxidation, but the oxidation actually ends up working to your advantage, like I said, when it comes to kale, because it actively uses a forbane. So there's several different things in that. The reason why I use the Bravel Icon in particular, because it's a little bit more of a pricier model, but it's because I'm working on a cellular level. I needed to have consistency and consistent results. So that's the reason why I decided to go with that. However, when you're just ingesting it, I would imagine a cheaper Bravel model or a cheaper juicer might do the same work, but I can't personally vouch for it because I haven't worked with it. But working with the Icon, it's been consistently very reliable in terms of producing wonderful results.
Who cleans your machine when you're done making the juice?
Sorry, I couldn't hear you say it again.
Who cleans your machine when you're done making the juice?
I do. So it's a long process. Not that long, actually. It's quite easy. It takes proper planning. So I would put a garbage bag in the container so I can just take that out easily and just dump off the pulp and scrubbing it. It takes only maybe like 15-20 minutes to clean it up.
I just bring that up because a lot of people complain about cleaning the machine after making juice.
Oh, no. This was the whole reason why I kind of got a little desperate, because I was juicing kale in bulk. So we're talking about a lot of kale. I'm talking about well over 60 leaves of kale I was doing that time, and that still took me only 15-20 minutes to clean it up after that. So I would imagine most people would probably take 5 minutes cleaning up after themselves. It shouldn't be terribly hard, especially with the design of the Bravel. Like I said, it's very, very well designed.
So we just have a few minutes left. Dr. Brandon, what are the plans with kale in your research in the future?
Well, we are going to try it out on some different cancer cell lines and evaluate its efficacy with those. We're also going to look at the effects of kale on inflammatory cells. So immune cells respond very differently, sometimes very low concentrations of chemicals, and we would like to see how inflammatory cells become activated or become less active in response to exposure to kale juice. So I think that would be really neat.
Absolutely. Well, my understanding is that the cruciferous vegetables, the dark leafy green vegetables, do two things specifically, and I look forward to more science to prove what I'm about to say, but they boost the immune system, but they also help detox and take out things that aren't good for the body. So I would imagine that would definitely be seen in an inflammation type of study.
Yeah, we hope so. And the thing that we'll continue to do is publish the research in an open forum so that anyone has access to our research results.
And actually, in regards to the detoxification, there is actually a study that's confirmed what you're saying in regards to sulfur. It upregulates the smooth endoplasmic reticulum in the liver. So there actually are studies showing that it does aid in the detox. It has detoxifying effects on the body.
Now, the last thing I wanted to mention is my understanding is in terms of a human consuming this food and getting the nutrition, a lot of the nutrition is fat soluble, and it's important to consume a little bit of fat with kale or other similar dark leafy green vegetables. So is there anything like that you might include in your study to see if that improves any of the results?
Well, the solubility is less of an issue simply because those fat-soluble molecules will probably diffuse across the cell membrane. You just have to make sure that you use a low enough concentration so that you don't overdose the cells. But whatever bioactive compounds are there are very effective without the aid of any fatty acid mixtures in the medium or albumin to bind to some of those fat-soluble molecules in the kale juice.
Hmm.
So it's it's already very, very effective. Now, I would say that with the sonicating, the kale juice, the sonication will disrupt the membranes in the mitochondria and the chloroplast, and it's possible that some of the antioxidant molecules are liberated by this mechanical disruption. They're still there. They're just maybe exposed to the aqueous environment so that they have greater access to the cells.
Well, I think this is really very exciting, and I look forward to more work coming out from Mississippi College, from Bilal and Dr. Brandon, and kale. There's nothing kale can't do, right?
Right.
Thank you for joining me. It's all about food.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Okay, go back to work.
All right.
Okay, thank you. Wow, really interesting information there, and I'm a big believer in kale, and I'm even more of a believer now. So let's take a little bit of a break, and I'll be back with my next guest, Richard Schwartz. Hey everybody, we're back. I'm Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to the second part of It's All About Food today on April 1st, 2014. How are you? I have to say that it's been a rough few weeks for me, and as you know, I was not doing very well last week, but you can probably hear in my voice that I'm recovering from the nasty bug that I had. And the body always amazes me at its ability to heal when you give it the tools it needed. And I certainly needed a lot of rest. Kale juice didn't hurt. And it's good health is so important. It's so good to feel good, and it's so bad not to feel good. And that's one of the things that's important to me here on It's All About Food, talking about health and the simple things that we can do so that we do feel good for a very, very long time and live a long quality life. Now, I want to talk about living a long quality healthy life with my next guest. Richard Schwartz is President Emeritus of the Jewish Vegetarians of North America after serving as president for many years and over 35 years of promoting vegetarian, veganism, animal rights, and environmental activism. He can speak from a unique perspective that can produce a game changer in promoting vegetarianism. He's the author of 4 challenging books, Judaism and Vegetarianism, Judaism and Global Survival, Who Stole My Religion, Revitalizing Judaism, and Applying Jewish Values to Help Heal Our Imperiled Planet, and Mathematics and Global Survival, and over 200 articles and book reviews, and 25 podcasts at jewishveg.com/Schwartz. Richard, welcome to It's All About Food.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be on, and kudos for all the great things you're doing, and I hope you continue to feel better and better.
Thank you. Well, first of all, you're turning 80 in May.
Yeah, actually, birthday's in April, but I'll be away, so the celebration's going to be in May.
Oh, I see. What day is your birthday?
April 10th.
April 10th. My birthday is April 22nd, Earth Day.
Well, I guess I'm, about 12 days older than you then.
That's right. 12 days and a little bit. Well, you are certainly looking good. I want to know who did the cartoon of you looking like super vegetarian.
Okay, well, that's somebody, our new executive director, Jeff Cohan, got and first saw that, I almost burst out laughing, and this was really amazing, amazing. But, you know, we almost need superheroes nowadays. The threats are so great. Climate change and the health, the epidemic of disease, et cetera, the hunger. So that's why it's great that your program is on and why we got to get our messages out there as effectively as we can.
Now, I want to know, how have you stayed so enthusiastic and so inspired about the same message for so long?
Well, it's like there's no alternative. It's very easy to give up because when you see, and just this week, there's that report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and how things are bad already, and unfortunately it can get a lot worse. And there was a report just a few days before that, an amazing, amazing thing that every single year in the 21st century, is in the top 14. Only 1 year, 1998, is in the top 14 other than the 13 years in the 21st century. And yet there's so much denial out there and people saying, actually, we've been cooling. 1998 happened to be a very warm year. And not every year has been higher than that, just a couple, but every one of them is way, way up there. And 2013 was either fourth or seventh, depending on which group you're looking at. You know, slightly different ways of measuring, but every year in this century has been warm, as I say, among the top 14. And every decade since the 1970s has been warmer than the previous one. And we're seeing the effects out there in terms of the droughts that affected more than half the U.S. This past summer, of course, now in California, and the mudslide in Washington, and the superstorms like Sandy and Katrina, and the flooding. I mean, this has to become like a number one issue. And unfortunately, many people are not aware that animal-based diets and agriculture are a major, major factor, largely because of the methane given off by cows, which in the 20 years that methane's in the atmosphere, it's 72 times as potent as carbon dioxide in heating up the planet. So we got to get that message out, and it's got to become a priority, because if we don't avert the impending climate catastrophe, hate to think of the kind of world we're going to be leaving for our children and grandchildren, all future generations.
Now, how did you get so smart, and when did you get so smart?
I'm sort of just standing on the shoulders of giants. And you have, as I mentioned, an intergovernmental panel on climate change. And you've got 97% of the climate experts all agreeing. And even more than that, it's like 99.9%. If you look at the refereed articles in respected journals, and that's the important thing, and every science academy. So if I'm smart, it's because I'm able to see what all these wonderful scientists are doing, and just I'm the middle person trying to spread the word between the climate experts and the average person.
Well, yeah, I'm right there with you, and I know how important the grassroots work is and getting to individuals one by one by one, and I don't want to be pessimistic. I want to remain with a certain amount of optimism and hope.
Mm-hmm.
But it definitely is a very challenging time, and for many of us, we see that the solutions are really very simple, but I think humans have a number of characteristics that may have been beneficial in some instances, but they're detrimental when we talk about the environment. We're very short-sighted. We don't like to look very far into the future.
Right.
We're concerned about our own generation, our own well-being, our own economics.
Right.
And it's really hard to look beyond that, really hard.
Mm-hmm. But it's essential, because we need that looking into the future. And unfortunately, it's not just the future. It's happening already, as we've mentioned. Almost every other day on the news, it's like a flood here, a tornado, the drought in this area, the mudslide. And, of course, you can't point and say every one is related to climate change, but the thing is that there's so many more. You know, when you add all of them up, they're all consistent with what the experts are saying. And just, I think it was last year, for the first time in human history, the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere hit 400 parts per million.
Yep.
And as you probably know, there's that wonderful, wonderful group called 350.org. And the reason it has that name is that 350 is what climate experts think is like a cutoff point for safety. So we're 50 points above that, and unfortunately increasing rather than moving back to that 350 level. So we could be very close, if God forbid we haven't already passed it, to a tipping point where climate change could spin out of control. So again, it has to be extremely important. And when you realize that, of course, it's not just that, it's the negative effects of animal-based diets and agriculture on human health, and of course the unbelievably cruel conditions on factory farms, and causing deforestation and the water pollution, and very inefficient use of water and land and energy and other resources. That's why I say unfortunately, it's like madness and sheer insanity.
Yes.
You know, and what we need is, as somebody pointed out, like the moral madness or the moral passion of the biblical prophets. We have to be more always respectful. But the challenge that I've tried to do very respectfully within Judaism, but all the religions are based on compassion, but point out that, number one, God's earth is threatened as never before, and there are what I call the six mandates that point, religious mandates, that point to vegetarianism, your ideal diet, and these are to take care of our health, to treat animals with compassion, to be co-workers with God in protecting the environment, to conserve natural resources, helping hungry people, seeking and pursuing peace, all fundamental to every single religion, and that's why religious leaders and religious people in general should be in the forefront of efforts to increase awareness that we need to switch to vegetarian diets and, of course, vegan diets even more for so many, many reasons.
Well, why do you have any idea why religious leaders are not doing what you say they should be doing, since it's such a fundamental premise behind what most religions are about?
Right. Well, first of all, I'm happy to say that there are some, of course, that are doing it, and more this is happening, and especially it's interesting in Israel, there's been a sharp movement toward veganism in the recent years.
I'm glad you brought that up. I was going to ask you about that, so if you can share any details, I'd appreciate it.
Okay, so yeah, that has been happening, but just to get back a bit more to your question, to me it's tragic. I call this the tragedy of religion, that religion has powerful teachings, but in general they're not being applied to the issues. That's why I've written my books, Judaism and Global Survival, for example, and of course Judaism and Vegetarianism. And the other one, Who Stole My Religion?, applying Jewish values, and again, this can be applied to other religions, but applying Jewish values to help revitalize Judaism and help heal our imperial planet, because there's such powerful teachings, but there's too much of what one of my favorites, Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, called religious behaviorism, and not looking into it and saying, how can we apply the powerful teachings on justice, on peace, on sharing, on compassion to a world that's broken in many ways and needs these teachings today more than ever before?
Yeah, our world is definitely broken. So what about what's been going on in Israel? I've been reading all kinds of interesting things about veganism in Israel.
Right. Well, there's one guy, you may have heard of, Gary Yourofsky, that's been giving some talks there, and that really has started. And some of these celebrities there have come out for it, and it's just it's gone like viral, in effect, and it's just been picking up. On the other hand, there's still a long, long ways to go. You know, it's still a relatively small percent, but it's been growing. Things are happening, but it's got to happen much faster. As I say, this has to become a central organizing principle. We're responding to climate change, to hunger, to thirst, and that's the incredible thing to me. I was mentioning hunger, for example, that with 20 million people dying of hunger and its effects every year, and almost a billion people chronically hungry, it's really shameful, astounding. 70% of the grain produced in this country, the corn, oat, soy, etc., being fed to animals destined for slaughter. And what makes it to me even more shameful is we're taking healthy products, this soy and corn, etc., high in complex carbohydrates and fiber, no cholesterol at all, no saturated fat. We feed them to animals, and we end up with a product very high in saturated fat and cholesterol and devoid of complex carbohydrates and fiber. So it's really amazing. And
it's lunacy. It's just lunacy.
Well, that's why I say we need the madness of the biblical prophets. We have to go, and I hope everybody listening to your wonderful program will go to their minister, priest, rabbi, imam, and now very respectfully say, can't we get this on our agenda? Can't we have a study group about it? Or maybe you can give a sermon about it, because, as I say, God's earth is threatened. And we're not, God forbid, saying, let's start a new religion. It's in all the religions. They've got all the teachings. It's put it into practice. And we should go to medical conventions and really challenge them and say, you know, medical practice today is really medical malpractice.
Yeah.
If doctors do not tell their patients about the many medical benefits of plant-based diets.
Well, a lot of them even roll their eyes when you say that that's what you want to do, that you want to eat plant food.
Absolutely. But they're not educated for that, unfortunately. They're educated more for cure rather than prevention. And, you know, take this pill for that, and if there's this side effect, then take this other pill for that. And we're a pill-popping society, and we could prevent so many diseases, so much attention, rightly so, on Affordable Care Act. That's how do we pay for it? But we could save so much money with prevention and healthier people, and things could be a lot better.
You were talking before about resources and water and what the land is good for, and I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but earlier this I was going to say earlier this month, but actually it was early in March. We're already into April.
Right.
I went and spoke to about 250 cattle producers on climate change at an event sponsored by a livestock company. And it was fascinating to me to be there, to tour the feedlot, and to see all the things that I so intensely don't believe in, to see it actually going on in front of me. But the thing that was amazing to me is how people did not see what I saw.
Mm-hmm.
We clearly came and looked at the same landscape with a completely different point of view and a completely different vision. So what I saw, I was in Nevada, and in this particular mountainous area of Nevada, you have the mountains and the valleys, and it's very sparse, it's very dry, it's very desert-like. And I kept looking as we were driving around this area, how could anything live here?
Mm-hmm.
And then I saw these feedlots, which are really, really ugly. They're just vast amounts of acreage of dirt fenced in, and these poor animals inside them. You don't see a tree anywhere. When I was talking to these people about the importance of eating more plants and less animals and how devastating it is for the environment and impacting climate change, many people said to me, our land isn't good for anything else but raising cattle. And I said to some of them, but I wanted to say to a lot of them, I didn't have the opportunity, this land isn't even good for raising cattle. You're bringing in all the food. You're not growing it there. You're bringing in all the water. This isn't suitable for what you're doing.
Sure.
And they don't see that.
Right. And acres of land in Iowa and other states are being used to grow those feed grains that you say are being brought in there. And, of course, that is having such negative effects. And we need a lot of irrigation water and running out of water. And animal-based diets per person takes up to 14 times as much water. You know, at a time when the aquifers have been shrinking, the glaciers melting, and so many areas, this may become, many feel, the big problem, the future, shortages of water, shortages of food. But tying in with what you're saying, you've probably heard that expression, denial is not a river in Egypt.
That's right. That's worth saying again. Denial is not just a river in Egypt, drying up river in Egypt. Yeah,
people just don't want to know. But, you know, things are happening that some politicians are getting involved and realizing we've got to make these changes, and we need leadership here to say we just can't keep going on this way. We're on a path toward tremendous catastrophe and destruction.
Yeah, I haven't had a chance to read the newest intergovernmental
panel.
I guess it just came out, or some of the information has just leaked out.
Leaked out, and it'll be out soon, but it's a massive, massive report, and you're talking about hundreds of scientists and excuse me, in a way it's a conservative document because it has to be consensus among many scientists and also many countries, and it's using documents for the last, say, 3, 4, 5 years perhaps. So if anything, it's not a conservative side, but it's indicating, you know, more and more floods and droughts and wildfires, and everything's connected to everything else. And we see that with the mudslide in Washington State. And
You know, I'm really glad you brought that up, because I was thinking about that and how it's such a metaphor for everything that humanity is doing. Because what I was reading about is that people knew that that particular area in Washington was prone to mudslides. They knew for a long time, and it was due to overlogging to the point where they removed all the trees that were holding up the earth.
Right. Yeah.
And in some ways, I mean, it's like a metaphor. We are removing things from the planet that are holding us together, that are keeping us together, and everything is just at one point just going to collapse.
Absolutely. Somebody said it's like a giant Ponzi scheme, you know, where things seem okay now, everybody's benefiting from the trees and making money perhaps, but there's disaster ahead. You know, there's going to be a price to be paid. And again, happening already in terms of that mudslide and the droughts and the wildfires and Hurricane Sandy here on the East Coast, and affecting the entire world, actually.
Okay, so let's, we just have a few minutes left, and I want to turn things around and talk about some things to celebrate. So there's going to be a big party for you to celebrate your 80th birthday, right?
That's correct.
Where's that going to be?
Okay, it's going to be in Manhattan, a place called Madras Mahal, I think it is. And if people want to find out more about it, they can go to the Jewish Vegetarians in North America. They're the ones sponsoring it. Their website, of course, www.jewish, followed by the first three letters of vegetarianism. So it's www.jewishveg.com. And if they continue that, then, which is the website of the Jewish Vegetarians in North America, and they put a slash, and the last name, S-C-H-W-A-R-T-Z, that's where, as you mentioned, I have 200 articles and 25 podcasts, a complete text of my book, Judaism and Vegetarianism, and also Judaism and Global Survival. And if people want more information, they can also email me at president@JewishVeg, again, oneword.com. And if anybody would like to volunteer to help out, there's so many things that need to be done, and I hope they'll contact me as well.
Okay, well, I always liked the opportunity to celebrate, and I'm glad there's going to be a big party for you. And so now you're going to be 80, you're going to be middle-aged, you're going to live to like 160 probably, so what are your future plans?
Well, I hope I can fulfill the poetic statement, grow old along with me, the best is yet to be, because there's so much to be done. And, you know, it's almost like the days are just not long enough, there's just not enough time. Well, we're trying everything possible. One thing I am trying is to restore and transform the ancient holiday Jewish New Year for animals. This was thing that unfortunately started many years ago when they had the sacrifices, so we wanted to get away from that, transform it, because Judaism, like other religions, has such powerful teachings on compassion for animals. It said God's compassion is over all his works, for example, and the book of Proverbs says the righteous individual considers the life of his or her animal. So we want to increase awareness of that, and also the very, very sharp contradictions between the beautiful religious teachings and the realities on factory farms and in so many other settings. So that's one thing, and I'm just trying to get articles out and mainly increase awareness, again, that it's essential that there be a major change to vegetarian and preferably vegan diets in order to avert a climate catastrophe. And, you know, we have to, again, respond with the moral passion of the biblical prophets, get this word out, and encourage listeners, write letters, speak to your politicians, religious leaders, and tell them, especially if you have children or grandchildren, that if you want a decent world for them, we've got to start right away and turn things around.
That sounds pretty good, and that's just about the best place we can end this program. So thank you for joining me, Richard Schwartz, and a very happy birthday to you in just a few days.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to be on your program.
Okay, I look forward to seeing you soon. Take care.
All the best. Bye-bye.
Well, you too. Bye-bye. I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food. Join me at ResponsibleEatingAndLiving.com, where you can find wonderful recipes and an archive of all these podcasts, and some of them are even transcribed. So have a delicious week, okay? Bye-bye.